One of the books on Betsy Burton's summer reading list this year is Geraldine Brooks' new novel, Horse. The horse is Lexington, a real Kentucky-based stallion who raced in the mid-1850s. Betsy says Brooks weaves together this array of different characters, and she goes back and forth from the present day to the 19th century.
There is, in the course of this book, a lot to do with the Civil War. And one of the equestrian artists is, in fact, a Union soldier, and he is put in charge of some Confederate prisoners of war.
In the beginning, he had spent much time with the prisoners. It was his duty, if they were wounded, to tend to them. At first, he was kindly disposed to these men, young as they were, skinny, sometimes shoeless rural boys, most from farms too poor to afford slaves. It had seemed to him an evil fate, a geographical accident, that had forced them to take up arms in what was, to him, a war to secure the rich man's wealth. Beyond what was strictly required for their care, he would talk to them to better know their minds. But after a time, he had stopped seeking such dialogue. They were, all of them, lost to a narrative untethered to anything he recognized as true. Their mad conception of Mr. Lincoln as some kind of cloven-hoofed devil scion, their complete disregard, denial, of the humanity of the enslaved, their fabulous notions of what evils the federal government intended for them should their cause fail, all of it was ingrained so deep, beyond the reach of reasonable dialogue or evidence. Scott had become convinced that a total obliteration of their rebellion was the only way forward. And since the drift of things was strong in that direction, he would see it through to the end.
If you took this quote and you took out Mr. Lincoln and you put in Biden, it could be today. That is the lesson of history that this book tells us. Nothing really has changed. It's chilling. It was chilling to read this paragraph, and the history is revealing in actually a quite an appalling way.
That's Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop, talking about the novel Horse by Geraldine Brooks, that excerpt read by the actor James Foley. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. And that one just gets us started today. It's our annual summer book show, where we gather our local book experts to give you some ideas for your summer vacation plans. And we'll get through as many of the books on their lists as we can. We'll post the rest on our website. Betsy joined us this week along with Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books and Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks. And we began with the same question I've been asking for 2 years now. How did their stores fare the pandemic?
Not much has changed. Independent bookstores have always been the publicity arm for publishers. So the way that the public hears about books that aren't bestsellers out of the chute is through us. Yeah. So even though COVID closed us down, we were still in continual contact with our customers, and we were talking about the books, which then turned the books into a bestseller or a book of interest. The only thing that
happened, COVID did not change that.
I don't think it did. I think it was our talking about. I mean, people were more desperate to hear what we had to say. They were insanely interested in the ideas that we had and the advice that we gave. So I don't think that's changed. I don't know. How do you two feel about it?
COVID has disrupted our supply chain issues.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Damazon is not the only enemy we have. Large publishers are also independent bookstore enemies. They don't care about us anymore. They don't want us. They're largely owned by multinational corporations. And this especially is it began long before COVID, of course, but it's led to, I think, a very healthy alliance between a host of new, young, upstart indie publishers finding their allies in independent bookstores. And we can make markets for new voices that aren't being published by the mainstream, by authors and minorities and women and on and on. And I think that's a really good thing. Our own Tory House Press is a great example of that. PM Press up in the Northwest is doing really radical Marxist stuff. And there's a lot of new voices that have been ignored for far too long that are coming out of this.
You know, Ken, that's really interesting. I haven't thought of it that way, but this consolidation of publishing has been happening for a good minute, and there have been publishers that basically go shopping, and large publishing houses that go shopping and pick up smaller imprints and smaller publishers, and it has not abated and has, in fact, increased. But this whole fragmentation and disruption of media, of culture, of how we speak and learn about things, and this move away from, you know, mainstream three television stations, five big publishers, it has opened up a lot for us, so that now we are not only showrooms, like Betsy's talking about, as places of discovery for these incredibly large media corporations, but we are seeing this natural alliance and this great growing of small indie presses that are bringing out new voices that really wouldn't be able to break through the noise of so many channels in so many different little markets these days. And that's pretty neat. I like that. I find that encouraging. But it does mean that independent bookstores, you know, I'm not the first person to say we're like cats. We think we're all very different, and we are all different to many degrees. But that place of discovery that we are, that Betsy and Ken have both talked about, has been empowered by both of those factors in this period, the shutdown where people needed, craved, wanted community, and the breaking of several things that has allowed small things for those of us who have the time to look at something, or the not time or luxury, the motivation to look at something besides a sell sheet, will allow really unique books. And you might have heard me say, whoa, with PM Press, because, oh, my Lord, what they're doing. It's lots of Marxism, but also really cool music history that they're doing. It's places like that, and yes, Tory House and AK Press, who's been around for a good minute, or Haymarket. It's a golden age for them right now.
There's a lot going on right now. An extraordinary January 6th hearings with a revelation every other day there. Of course.
Against the backdrop of 50 years of Watergate.
Of course. And then, of course, the polarizing Supreme Court ruling, or rulings, I should say.
The most jaw-dropping thing of all.
For sure. When you're talking about reading at a moment like this, it seems like you have two options. You look for escape, or you look to history or current events and just sort of lean into it. Mm-hmm. What are you finding right now, especially in the tale not so long ago, a week ago or so, of the Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe versus Wade? There's other things. So what are you noticing right now in terms of the way people are deciding up those two options? They just want to forget about it for a minute and go to the beach and read something frivolous, or do they want to just sort of make sense of the world? What do you notice?
A lot of anger.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of anger, a whole lot of looking for how and why this happened and ways forward.
Explaining
ways forward
through history what is going on now, if that's possible. But rage.
I keep waiting for the escapism to come. I haven't seen that yet in my sales. Because we saw that for a minute in COVID. You know, there was a time during COVID before the BLM blow up when people were just so – they'd lost the ground from under their feet, and there was a lot of escapism. And then people just drilled in and focused on things. And I think people are still pretty drilled in right now.
I agree.
So reading what, though? Again, histories, biographies, current events, what?
Well, yes. I find my truth in fiction. And the beauty of historical fiction is you can wind and merge and see the patterns in a way that you really can't when you're reading history, unless you're a brilliant historian. Some do it. And it's those patterns that we look for to make sense of the world. Mm-hmm. Mm.
You gave a list of options: current affairs, biography, history. Yeah. Yes, just
yes,
check those
that.
Boxes. And in sociological things. You know, I'll talk about a book that is basically
a study,
a longitudinal study.
Yeah.
People want real information, and that is one of the things that bookstores still do. We have seen the pitfalls of the internet and where nobody knows you're a dog or a Russian troll, or somebody who is well-intentioned but maybe not fully informed. But what going through the process of being published by a publishing house, be it a small independent house or a very large traditional publisher, is there is a process of review and checking. Not what it was, but it's still there. So what you're getting is, whether it's in historical fiction that's giving you patterns and information, or it's your writing of a longitudinal study, you're getting something that is, if you're looking for reality, it is firmly rooted there. Mm. You will find that there, and you'll find it well expressed.
I will confess to going back and trying to find all of the Lawrence Block, Matthew Scudder
there
novels I've never read,
yep.
And also his alias, Richard Stark, that are really, really dark and twisted novels. That's escape for me.
Yeah. Well, on that note of reality, it's a segue, Betsy, to begin, let's start.
Okay,
Betsy Burton.
So I'm going to start with a couple of novels that one is historical fiction, right on point with what we're talking about. It's by Geraldine Brooks. It's called Horse, and it is the history of probably in its time the most famous racehorse ever. His name was Lexington. He was raised in Kentucky, and the main characters are the horse himself and his groom. But it fingers out into history in a couple of directions. One, because it's before the Civil War, takes us through the Civil War and incorporates that history. And then the contemporary characters are a scientist at the Smithsonian who is investigating the skull of the skeleton of this horse, and an equestrian artist, art historian. That's a thing that really was, because in the days when racehorses were famous, they were painted over and over again. The thing that you have to remember reading about all this history is, if you ever liked My Friend Flicka or Thunderhead, the relationship between a boy and his animal or a girl and hers, this captures that passion in the groom, the horse's groom, and the horse. Fascinating in terms of history, heart-stopping in terms of the horse racing that goes on. So that is one wonderful new novel.
And say the title again.
The title is Horse. It's by Geraldine Brooks, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. And it's just a great read and a great lesson in history. This is Invisible America. This is what we did to make Native Americans invisible, whether just pulling them out of their tribes and their lands, sticking them in boarding schools, the things we did to them to annihilate their culture are just breathtaking. Aunt Ruby is a young woman. In some of the pieces, she's a child, in some an angry adolescent, in others a young and then an older woman who was adopted. Her mother was white. Her father, although she didn't know it for many years, was Métis. And she knew there was something missing, and her mother would not tell her adopted mother. And it is her effort, this whole novel is her effort to piece her past together. It is a really emotionally accurate book about how we tried our best to erase many, many cultures, the Native cultures that populated America before we came, and that are really still here despite our efforts to deny it.
Okay, Betsy Burton. Catherine Weller.
A couple of my books are actually from that weird shoulder season, February, which really isn't summer reading, but
mud season.
Mud season. They were so good. I am still recommending them and still selling them.
Great.
The first is a book called Lesser Known Monsters of the 21st Century. It's a book of short stories by Kim Fu from Tin House Press. And I picked this up at our trade show in the fall, where they're pushing books that publish in the spring, because the buzz about this was extraordinary. And I talked with her a while, and I thought, oh, this is a really interesting person, a really interesting writer. I read the first two stories, and I thought, boy, I don't know about this book. This is good writing, but it's just not catching me. I don't know what they're seeing here. And then I hit the rest of the stories, and whoa, I suddenly understood what they were talking about. Monstrosity can be so many things. Sometimes it is a lot of the tropes that she uses in here that are standard horror tropes that she turns on her head, on their heads, like the possessed doll and the kids that find the possessed doll. But she gives it a new life in a really interesting and strange way. Or the house that's infested by bugs. In this case, it's an Airbnb that's infested by one June beetle that all of a sudden turns into millions of June beetles everywhere. And it in this house that is supposed to be a refuge for someone. Or the story that just left me gobsmacked of a couple that has a great big 3D printer in their basement and little implants in their brains so that when they die, their consciousness downloads to the printer that prints a new body, uploads their consciousness so they don't die. And so what do? They start killing each other over and over and over again. It is jaw-dropping. I mean, she shoots him in the face. He poisons her. She kills herself a couple times in a couple ways. It is all so dark, but it is so well done and moving. Lesser Known Monsters of the 21st Century by Kim Fu. Segueing into The Candy House by Jennifer Egan, because it also deals with memory. This features an invention by a guy who was a character, a very minor character in her runaway hit, A Visit from the Goon Squad. His name is Bix. He creates this idea where you can download your consciousness, your memories, and make it accessible to everybody should they be willing to share their memories too. Do you want to see these memories? Do you want to interact with these memories? Do you want to see your dad's memories? I don't want to see my dad's memories of me. But there are a lot of sub-stories in here because that's how she writes, and a lot of layering. There's a very fascinating by narrative that happens in the middle that's very non-traditional in its structure. It just goes on and on in this wonderful, playful, non-traditional way that Jennifer Egan can do. Lastly, very quickly.
Say the name of that title.
Candy House by Jennifer Egan. Werner Herzog, The Twilight World.
He's getting a lot of talk.
Because he's Werner Herzog.
That's right.
Werner Herzog is asked while he's in Japan, do you want to meet the emperor? He says, oh, no, that would be boring. Who do you want to meet? He says he wants to meet the guy that lived on a Philippine island, defending it for years from people who are fighting the Japanese Empire. He does. And he has written this narrative about that man's time on this island. The fabulous thing about this book, or perhaps the detraction, is it is very difficult to read it without hearing Werner Herzog's very German voice. It's a great audiobook. If you need to access an audiobook through the summer, and you can do that in partnership with your independent bookstores, you don't have to use the evil Amazon and Audible. You can do that through Libro FM, and Werner Herzog reads it.
Great. Ken Sanders, over to you.
I've chosen to open with three nonfiction books by regional authors, Doug. The first is Craig Childs's newest title called Tracing Time, Seasons of Rock Art on the Colorado Plateau. We had him at the bookstore, Leo, a couple of months ago, and the book was new. This is, I believe, Craig's seventh or eighth book. He has a really refreshing way at looking at antiquities, if you will, and coming up with different observations and ways of seeing. Yeah. One of his earliest adventures, he's in his youth, I'm not certain he does or doesn't do this anymore, he used to jump in flash floods to see where they would take him. a very odd man. Craig's a friend, and I still say that with love. If anyone thinks they're going to read this book and he's going to tell you what all this old Fremont and ancestral problem rock art means, well, don't listen to him because he'd just be making it up and lying about it anyway. None of us know. We don't come from those cultures. We don't know what it means, but we're going to endlessly, fascinatingly try to figure it out. But he takes it beyond. It's not a book about that. It's about voyages, multiple voyages of discovery from rock art from, you know, one end of the planet to the other, but really concentrating and emphasizing the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah.
Another even older friend of mine has written his sixth or seventh book. Neither of these two men, they don't write, you know, a bestseller that comes out every fall. It takes these guys years of skin and blood to usually write a book. Doug Peacock, his latest is called Was It Worth It? And I just thought it was a phrase Doug made up until I read the book and realized from his long solo entradas deep into the heart of the Sonoran Desert and the Cabeza de Prieta, where he buried his late friend Edward Abbey, he found an old inscription three different times in the middle of that arid, vacant desert that dates back to the earliest part of the 20th century. But he wrote three times, Doug encountered three different rock art inscriptions by this 100-year-old Argonaut that said, with his name, and it said, carved on the rock, was it worth it? Well, Doug uses that title as an examination of his own life and his own place in the world, and he's got a lot of good stories to tell, and you should read them.
He does say the name of that again.
Was It Worth It by Doug Peacock. Lastly, Ari Barrio has got a new book out, The Backwoods of Everywhere, following up on his very first book, which was On the Bear's Ears. It came out in 2020. That fateful pandemic year. Really interesting observations and stories from a non-native of the area. This is a mixed bag of short nonfiction stories that cover everything from his own personal woundings and physical and mental trials and tribulations to his own relationships with the landscapes.
Say the name of that one again.
The Backwoods of Everywhere, R.E. Barrio.
Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. We also have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks and Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop. We'll have a list of all the books we discussed and the ones we didn't get to. It's on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thanks to KUER's mobile app, you can keep NPR Utah as your essential connection wherever you go. Our free mobile app keeps you informed with the latest local stories from KUER News. Explore on-demand podcasts like Radio West, State Street, and Sent Away. Or enjoy nonstop streams of our daily programming, BBC World Service, and classical KUER. Stay connected to your member station with the KUER mobile app, available for free wherever you get your apps.
Not so long ago, a couple of local women came into my bookshop and they left a copy of this curious little chapbook. It's a little tiny book. It has perhaps 48 pages to it. It's completely black cover with two white letterpress words called Lake Words, and the authors are listed only as Milo and Ivy. That's it. That's all you get. I mean, it's the essence of sparseness. I became instantly fascinated by it. Got hold of one of the women, and I bought a bunch of copies from them. This book is a polemic about the dying of the Great Salt Lake, the realities behind why the lake might be dying, and what could we possibly do about it. Lake words. I walk on the shore of an ancient sea, my steps crackling the exposed lake bed. I walk across countless bodies, dead microbialites, bleached white, tiny beings. They photosynthesize, provide nourishment, then turn to rock. Something about biology doing chemistry to become geology. Damn. Some of the first critters to live on Earth's surface, here they are, laid bare, the receding shoreline, exposing them to air and sun. Like fish out of water, they cannot last long. May we cry our grief and praise, see our tears buoy this great body to swollen shorelines. May this uprising sweep away the dams choking what we know this body needs. May we show up on purpose. May we say, I was wrong. Wash away the apathy. Let the causeways drown. May I-15 go underwater forever. Open wide the floodgates. Wash away extractors from the shore. May we never again measure this body by economic value. May we count our blessings by the flaps of wings. May we be the ancestors who stepped in the path of destruction and said no more. To the lake, the center, thank you for holding all of this. What I like about Lake Words is its sincerity, its love, and its just unabashedness. It's just straight out, this is the way it is. Wake up, people.
Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, reading from the chapbook Lake Words by Milo and Ivy. It's our annual summer book show today. We have with us Ken, along with Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop, and Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks. Catherine Miller, back to you.
All right, nonfiction, my baby. And we know that I read a lot in current events, and we know I'm not necessarily a fun person. So I'm going to just jump into all of that,
true, right?
I'm going to lean in. First off, One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America by Nick Seabrook. This is a big history of gerrymandering. I mean, we've talked a lot about gerrymandering in the past little while here. He begins with talking about how maybe gerrymandering should maybe be called Henrymandering. Americans learned gerrymandering. We came by it honestly. We got it from the British, who were doing it in colonial times, and we started doing it in colonial times too. Patrick Henry, fabulous gerrymanderer, one of the best, biggest gerrymanderers around, in fact. He was so effective at it that he changed the course of James Madison's career. How did he do that? Well, he basically got him out of office. There's a lot in here that's really interesting. It's not just the same old policy discussion about gerrymandering. It's stuff like that. It's stuff like the Lincoln-Douglas debate and how Lincoln's career was affected by gerrymandering, which it was. And then, of course, there are some policy reforms at the end because we know that's where things like this go eventually. Though America came by this honestly, learning it from the British no longer allow politicians to draw their lines anymore. No country does with a representative democracy, except for ours. And this shows the wide level of corruption that can happen on any level by any kind of politician if allowed to do that, because power wants to protect power. So, gerrymandering. One Person, One Vote by Nick Seabrook. Mm. Next, yes, it's a doorstop. And yes, we're in the middle of our own constitutional crisis. But Watergate, A New History by Garrett M. Graff. If you think you learned everything the first time around, you didn't. This book is really deep, and it was able to access archives and writings that were not necessarily freely available at the time. My takeaway from this is these situations don't start overnight. The people don't crop up out of nowhere. The structures that allow Richard Nixon to do what he did, he was working towards that a good minute in the White House before we got to Watergate. This is pretty compelling stuff, and it's really good reading, so just jump on in. Last, I've got the Turnaway Study, which is the book I referenced about a longitudinal study, but it is a narrative packed with data. This is the findings of a survey that went over 10 years of about 1,000 women who tried to access abortion at abortion clinics. And either they were not able to get an abortion or they were. They were checked in with at least twice a year, as I recall, by these researchers who kind of evaluated their lives. So we saw how getting an abortion did or didn't affect their lives over time. Mm. Highly readable. The women have voices in here, too. Well worth checking out. Spoiler alert, it's not what they told us.
Ken Sanders, over to you.
Well, on that note... it's really hard to talk about Barry Lopez and his new posthumous book, this Embrace Fearlessly, The Burning World, Essays. They're brilliant. He's as good in death as he ever was in life. He, from that first book, the Desert Notes, it ends with a short story about the white buffalo that was just – it just brings chills to you. And he went on to Of Wolves and Men and then Arctic Dreams and all the rest. I remember we were going to – me and Barry and Terry Tempest Williams, other – we were going to go down to Lake Powell in the 80s and do an expedition underwater to see what the river was still like down among the mud and the silt. And I'm so sad that we never, ever pulled that expedition off. If we had, Barry certainly would have written about it. Now, how I would have participated, not being able to swim and afraid of water, I would never know. But I can't recommend any book that Barry Lopez ever wrote more highly than this one, because nobody's read it yet.
Say the title one more time.
Embrace Fearlessly, The Burning World. Zora Neale Hurston, she'd been gone.
Man, you're shifting all over the place here. Great.
Well, you don't know us Negroes, a fairly antiquated term today, but this is her essays from before the Harlem Renaissance, during the Harlem Renaissance, and after the Harlem Renaissance, and includes essays never, ever published. Perhaps she and Langston Hughes were the two most important authors to come out of the Harlem Renaissance, and I highly recommend her voice. It gave voice to Alice Walker and Toni Morrison and all the rest.
All right. Betsy Burton, over to you.
Okay. I'm going to talk about a couple of nonfiction and then slip in a couple of mysteries because I always manage to miss them and I don't want to. My first one is The Colony by Sally Denton. It details both the back history and the occurrence of the massacre of women and children in 2019 in Mexico from two different colonies of polygamists, which was all over the news and which everybody read about and everybody's read since then about the investigations by the Mexican authorities. What is fascinating about this book is she gives us the whole backdrop. She starts with Joseph Smith and you think, what is this, a thumbnail sketch of Mormonism? But what it is all the way through is a thumbnail sketch of Mormonism just drawn around polygamy and blood atonement. That's the through line for the whole history she gives. And seen through that perspective, the history becomes ever more interesting. I mean, it's fabulous. So you go back and you go forth. then there are the two towns. One, you know, the progeny of Urvil Le Baron, and we all know about him and the mass murderer that he was, which she details. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about all of this, but oh my God. So there is that, and though that group, and then a group on the other side of the mountain. And is it the cartel friends that they both had? I mean, they both worked with the Mexican cartels. Is it the people that they stole water from, which they did? You know, there are so many suspects that you can hardly stand it. And in reading all of this, you get such a picture of the thirsty, arid West, a blood atonement of what drove polygamy. It's a fascinating book, and I couldn't put it down. It was better than the mysteries I'm about to tell you about.
It's called The Colony.
It's called The Colony. The subtitle, Faith and Blood in a Promised Land. Just very briefly, because I had to bring Margaret Atwood. She is the best. Look at that face. She's the best mind of our generation, of her generation. She's just wonderful. And this, which is essays and occasional pieces, which I won't begin to describe, except to say, put this on your bedside table. Dip into it from time to time, and every time you'll come up either beaming or with an epiphany. She's wonderful. Okay, just a very brief couple of books that I just want to tell you about as first novels.
Well-worn.
My husband and I both.
Okay.
Gatekeeper. Just briefly, if you were ever a Jack Reacher reader and you got sick of him because he got boring, this guy is kind of a Jack Reacher character, except he's Irish, he's small, he has a great sense of humor, and a devilish mind.
So it's, Tom Cruise could play him in the
movie. He could. But his accent, no, he couldn't pull it off. He doesn't really have a sense of humor. Gatekeeper.
By
James Byrne. Yeah. Okay, Torqued Man. This is the first novel. I love finding first novels. This is set in Berlin. There are two spies. One's German, and he's very analytical, and he's picked up an Irishman. The Germans loved Irish spies. And the two leave manuscripts, which are very different from one another. This is a fascinating book. It's also passionate and brilliant and impossible to put down. I've never read anything like it.
Wow.
It's called The Torqued Man by Peter Mann.
Betsy Burton, co-founder, one-time owner of the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. Also here with us is Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake and Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake. If you didn't get a chance to write down a title, it's okay. We have all of these books, even the ones we didn't have time for, and we won't have time for all of them. They're on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
We understand. You don't really want to turn off NPR Utah, but you're busy. You've got no choice but to leave your radio behind. Well, why not turn to KUBR's podcasts? You can take a deep dive into politics the Utah way with State Street. Or maybe you're feeling wildly curious, in which case, check out the latest episode of Radio West. And don't miss Sent Away, our investigative podcast about Utah's troubled teen industry. Learn more at KUBR.org/podcast.
Back in the day, I indexed a book, a medical treatise, all about the carotid artery. It was one of the most intensive, anxiety-inducing, difficult experiences of my life. It's really an undertaking to index. So this book by Dennis Duncan, Index, A History of the, is a history of the index and how we got there. He is a lecturer in English at the University College in London, and he has done an index or two in the past. So I really wanted to see what this guy had to say about indexing. There are a lot of things about the index that we take for granted, and one of them is the basic ways it functions. For an index to function, there had to be an evolution in bookmaking. You can't simply index a scroll. You can't simply index gatherings of paper. It has to be a gathering of paper that has certain traits.
I am in the Bodleian Library in Oxford with a small printed book open on the desk in front of me. This is the text of a sermon, and it was printed in 1470 in Cologne. The sermon was written by Werner Rolleving, a monk from the Cologne Charterhouse. If the truth be told, however, it is neither Rolleving nor his preaching that make this book special for me. It is something else, something about the book itself. There, in the right-hand margin, halfway down, a single large capital J. The ink has bled slightly, the impression slightly too strong, so that the letter is a little smudgy, without the detail and clarity of the Gothic lettering in the main text block. In fact, our J is not really a J at all. It is there as a numeral, 1, announcing that this is the first leaf of the book. Our J is the first printed page number. It will revolutionize the way that we use books, and in doing so, it will become such a commonplace that it will almost disappear from view, hiding in plain sight at the edge of every page.
It's a miracle. The miracle of the page number. It's that kind of thing that makes this book so cool. It's about discovery, which is what the index is about.
Catherine Weller with Weller Bookworks. You heard the actor Neil Gardner reading from Daniel Duncan's book, Index, A History of the... It's our annual summer book show. Catherine joined us this week along with Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books and Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop. They're offering book ideas for your summer vacation. Ken Sanders, you're up.
Children's books. So as I'm moving into the Leonardo, I'm creating a 300-square-foot children's room over there, and I have thousands and thousands of boxes full of children's books to put out, and we're really close to at least opening up that part of it. And I can't wait. We're picking out children's rugs to go down, shelves so low down where kids can reach books. We got a little robot bookcase, and I'm really having fun designing it, and I can't wait to add the children to the books mix.
Right.
So I've got three quick ones for you here. Wishy Washy, a first words and colors book written and illustrated by Tabitha Page.
Right.
The Queen in the Cave by Julia Sarda. It's beautifully illustrated, and it takes kind of traditional fairy tales, off into a little different, more contemporary sense. It's kind of like The Secret Garden, but updated. But yeah, there is a garden involved.
Nice. Say the title again.
The Queen in the Cave by Julia Sarda.
All right.
Everywhere With You by Carly Sorosiak. I can't pronounce her name. Illustrated by Devin Hallsworth. And this one features a young girl and her... are they fantasy adventures or are they real? You have to decide. Everywhere With You by Carly Sorosiak. Sorry for butchering your name. Illustrated by Devin Hallsworth. Right. And then a totally non-kids book, A Life in Focus, The Photography of Graham Nash. Graham Nash is a famous musician, mm-hmm. and he has taken photographs of all the famous people that he's known over the years. But he is a dedicated photo historian, photography collector, and photographer. And these photographs will completely and utterly amaze you. And I got him to sign my copies for me.
Wow, brilliant. All right, Betsy Burton.
Okay, my first book is a book about books. It's a picture book for children by, arguably the best children's and young adult and chapter book author in our community, Shannon Hill, illustrated by Tracy Subasek. This book is not for you. It's about a day at the mobile library, the bookmobile, when the librarian isn't there and Stanley goes in to get a book. He sees one he likes, and the new librarian, this old guy, says, you can't take that book. It's about a girl. And so then his friend, who's a girl, comes in and he gives it to her. And Stanley says, well, gee, how about this book about a cat? No, that's for a cat. And a cat comes in. And then one about a robot and so on and so forth. Finally, he gives him a book about a squishy peach. Well, this is well and good. He goes out. They all read their books. Allosaurus comes in, though, and the librarian is a little scared, but he gives him the book he wants, which is about a pony. They all read their books. They start to trade their books, and pretty soon the librarian comes out and says, well, you guys are having fun. What's going on? They've traded their books, and they're all reading the books that they really wanted. Books are best when you get to choose them is the moral. There's another...
This book is not for you.
This book is not for you. Shannon Hill and Tracy Subasac.
Great.
The World Belonged to Us is a wonderful book by Jacqueline Woodson, and illustrated by Leo Espinoza, which just briefly is about summer in Brooklyn, You know, with hydrants and ball games and fun from dusk to dawn, or dawn to dusk, actually. And how it never changes all summer long, and how that is summer all over the world. That's two of the four picture books I bought. The Wretched Water Park is a chapter book for younger kids by Kirsten White. She's written a lot of books, but this is a new series she started called Sinister Summer. It's about the worst water park in the universe. The kids are abandoned there for a week. There's no sunshine. There's no sand. There's no slides.
Is there water?
No. Well, there's mucky, awful, ghastly water. And there is a mystery. Spoiler alert here. It's about invisible and evil twins. And then it's the end of the world, and I'm in my bathing suit. Just briefly again, it's about a kid who hates to do the laundry and ends up in another world in his bathing suit.
Wow.
And then young adult, Melissa Gray, Valiant Ladies. This is set in Peru. It's a novel of derring do set in the 17th century. These girls grow up together. They learn sword fighting and knife fighting. It's also a blistering romance. These two girls fall in love with one another. And it reminded me as I was reading it, it's just a compelling read, and I thought, this is like when I was 16 and I used to read what we called bodice rippers. So it's a great read, which I can't recommend highly enough. I have others on my list, but we're out of time.
All right. Valiant Ladies.
Valiant Ladies, Melissa Gray.
Okay. Catherine Weller.
Okay, my first one is a board book, and it's third in what I consider to be a series that was started by Inosanto Nagara with the fabulous book A is for Activist, also a board book. These are books for toddlers. That was followed up with Counting on Community, which was a counting book. So these are all kind of social justice books, right? This new one has an author, Mona Damluji, again, apologies for mispronouncing, illustrated by Inosanto still. It's called Together. And what this book does is it starts with a one, and then the next piece of the spread is a collective. So one star shines as distant night, and when our stars shine together, they make our galaxy. It goes through these instances of singularity and then collectiveness. One of us can speak up for justice, and when we speak up together, we create a world of possibility. Is the end. You guys know I'm a sucker. I'm not any fun, but I'm weepy. So Together by Mona Damluji, the whole series is just dynamite for kids. Big and Small and In Between is another heartfelt book. This is about just the little wonders in the world. The trophy you got for the jump rope contest because your feet remembered the pattern. The kids on the playground when you wanted to use the seesaw, so you used the swing instead. The tea parties, the dogs. It's just these lovely illustrations with these brief moments day by day that allow us to access and talk about feelings. It's a wonderful read about loud book. It's a great grandparent book. It's so rich.
Yep.
Big and Small and In Between by Carter Higgins. I Am Quiet, a story for the introvert in all of us. This is about a kid named Emil. He's not shy. He's quiet. And it explores his inner life on the inside because he's not a dullard. He's not shy. There is a world. He contains multitudes in there. And it talks about that interior life that kids and people who are quiet have. So I Am Quiet by Andy Powers. quickly, Mary Roach, Packing for Mars for Kids. We all love Mary Roach. Here's an entry point for your middle grade readers. And Sarah Czar, the young adult author, has dropped down in writing level, meaning age level, to middle grades, A Song Called Home, one of her lovely, heartfelt, realistic fiction books. Song Called Home, Sarah Czar.
Terrific. Okay. Let's do a quick lightning round. Betsy, something you left behind? Do you have something in mind?
Well, absolutely. Love Marriage, Monica Ali, a wonderful comedic novel about a young woman in medical school and her would-be husband who has sex addiction as a hidden problem in his life.
Wow. Do another.
Okay. Ali Smith, companion piece, a novel, Ali Smith. She's a Brit. She's been shortlisted for the Booker. She's a wonderful writer, and this covers the year of COVID and then takes us back to medieval times when there was another plague.
Wow.
It's wonderful.
Ken?
Abecedario de Juarez, an illustrated lexicon by Julian Cardona and my friend and Alice Leora Briggs, inspired by Charles Bowden's writings. This is a chilling and disturbing lexicon of the whole world of the Juarez drug cartels. Black Utah, Stories from a Thriving Community by the Utah Black Chamber, a great history of African Americans in Utah and a contemporary story of who they are and what they're doing.
Foraging the Mountain West by Thomas J. Elpel. You all know you want to get out there and find those mushrooms, those gooseberries. This will help you do it. Easy Beauty, a memoir by Chloe Cooper Jones. This is a woman who was born with a birth anomaly, who is also a doctorate in philosophy, and talks about accessing what is beauty and what is considered good in this world.
Wow. Catherine Weller, she's with Weller Bookworks. Ken Sanders with Ken Sanders Rare Books. Betsy Burton, the co-founder of the King's English Bookshop. Well done, you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
We didn't get to all the books on the list, of course, but you can find them all on our website, RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you with your own book suggestions for the summer season. We're on Twitter, @RadioWest. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Carrie Watson. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.